This is Jasper Francis. I'm here at the Hudson Area Library History Room with Jonathan Osofsky. It is Friday, May 15th, 2026, and we're recording an oral history interview for the HAL LGBTQ Plus Oral History Project in collaboration with Out Hudson. Jonathan, I'm really glad you are here with me today.
I'm glad too. We've been talking about this for a while.
So I know. It's nice. Could you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Jonathan Osofsky.
Tell me a little bit. Let's get started with where did you grow up?
I grew up in a town called Ancrumdale, which is about 20 miles from Hudson, on a dairy farm. And it's a very small town. Mm-hmm. And at the time, in that era, there were lots and lots and lots of farms, but there are very few left. But my family has a dairy and has been there for a few generations.
Tell me a little bit more about your childhood growing up in the area. Did you like living on a farm, or was it sort of a...
When I was young, I mean, I loved living on a farm. I loved animals. I loved being able to wander. There were lots of fields and woods and places like that. So in some ways it was very idyllic. I mean, I wouldn't characterize my childhood as idyllic, but where I was very idyllic. And when I was young, that really resonated with me. I liked to be outside. I liked to kind of go exploring and sit by, streams and watch water. And, I was kind of a little nature boy when I was young.
Were you involved in, working on the farm?
Definitely. I mean, I grew up when you grew up on a farm, you're kind of working on the farm when you're little. You feed the calves, and I would spend a lot of time at the barn with my father and kind of follow him around. And and then as I got older, I worked on the farm until I was a teenager in some form, late teens until some form or another. Mm-hmm. And then when I moved to New York, I actually worked for the dairy too, because we had a little store in Chelsea Market, and so I worked there when I first moved to New York.
Oh, okay.
In my early 20s.
Did you and your family spend much time in Hudson when you were young, or?
Not really. Hudson was we were more oriented because we were right on the border of Dutchess County. So I grew up in Ancrumdale in Columbia County, but I went to school in Pine Plains, which is in Dutchess County. But I did come to Hudson occasionally. Both of my grandmothers would come on, come shopping at the, bigger supermarkets. We grew up in a small town, so there was a, that when they wanted to stock up, sure. They both liked to cook. We would come to Hudson and things like the DMV and stuff like that. But we were much more oriented toward south. Mm-hmm. To Rhinebeck or Red Hook or places like that. But I did come to Hudson, and it was, I remember it. I remember Warren Street when I was a kid being, very, very different than it is now, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I didn't spend a lot of time in Hudson. I also would, I remember my grandmother telling me about some of the history of Hudson and some of the, centered around, vice and when Governor Rockefeller had the Hudson was raided, and you know, all of the
right.
sort of quote unquote corruption was eradicated or addressed at least. But I didn't really spend a lot of time here as a kid.
What was your school life like? What system were you in?
I was in the public school in Pine Plains.
Okay.
I was a, you know, very intellectually curious kid. I was very creative, but I was a very, I wouldn't say that I was a good student. I was a good student in things that I was interested in, and sometimes a terrible student in things that I wasn't interested in. Mm. And part of my backstory is that I had, from at a very young age, I wasn't diagnosed this until later, but I have obsessive compulsive disorder. So that was kind of made my childhood a little complicated and made school a little complicated. But I went to public school for my whole education. Mm.
And did you move to New York and start working at the storefront in Chelsea Market right after graduation, or was there?
No, so I went to school for I graduated from high school and I went to SUNY Purchase for film. I did not last there very long because I was, you know, just kind of a troubled. I had a lot of stuff going on with OCD, with my, you know, sort of emergent sexuality, those being folded together, kind of interconnected. Mm-hmm. When I went to college, it was the first time that I was, you know, away from my parents and away from grown-ups, and where I sort of felt that I could kind of express myself in the way that I felt. But I also started to experiment with drugs and things like that. And so I was kind of a, you know, it was not a good time. But I went to SUNY Purchase for film. I ended up not completing that period of education. And then over the next 10 years, I got deeply, unfortunately, deeply involved in heroin. And I was a heroin addict for about 10 years. And kind of, you know, going to school, not going to school, wandering, kind of, you know, moving to different places. You know, it was the kind of zeitgeist in a way that I felt like I was part of.
Sure.
It felt very meaningful in a way. Initially, it felt sort of profound and radical and exciting, but it was really a nightmare. I mean, it was, you know, not any of those things that it seemed to be at first. But for me, because I was such an anxious kid and because of my OCD, when I first experimented with it, and I never thought that I ever would, I was very opposed to it, weirdly, but it sort of slipped away very quickly because I fell in love with this boy and he was using heroin, and he offered it to me, and I just, you know, all of my resistance like caved, and that began that adventure.
Okay. Just for a little context, what years were, was that period between like graduating high school, purchase, and...
So I graduated high school, and I was just going to say my birth year accidentally, which is really funny. I graduated from high school in 1991, and I was at a purchase from from 91 to like... 93, but I was there also. I actually ended up getting, this is a scandalous oral history. I ended up getting kicked out of school because of drugs, but not because of me, but sort of indirectly. But I ended up continuing to stay there and live there in my friend's dormitory. And so I was kind of like a pretend student for about a year. And then at that time, I was sort of spending more and more time in New York, and then I moved to New York with a friend in 92 or 93.
Was drug use a big part of the culture you were in at the time?
I think drug use was part of the larger culture. It wasn't, and drug use obviously finds itself in queer culture.
Yes.
But heroin wasn't really the sort of popular drug within queer culture. It was much more like, I was much more engaged with kind of rock and roll and music, you know, youth culture that and a lot of the people that we looked up to in the early 90s were all using heroin. And it seemed so liberating and cool. And I mean, so it sounds funny to say that now. But, you know, I really fell for that vision of it and kind of philosophized around it and thought it was a kind of radical strategy to be a junkie. The problem is that it kind of initially gives you a feeling that feels almost spiritual and feels almost profound, and for me with such extreme anxiety, it just eradicated all of my anxiety. So it seemed like this beautiful thing, but as I started to get deeper in, and people started to become concerned, I couldn't understand why they were concerned, because I was, for the first time, able to experience a lack of anxiety. But as I said, it's sort of a false reality. It's an illusion. It, you know, kind of took away a lot of things from me.
Can I ask what the tipping point was for starting recovery and getting clean?
I mean, because this went on for a long time, and you know, I ended up, you know, living in London with, I had a boyfriend who I met here, but moved to London to live with him, or he would come here, or just so many, all these years progressed in which it just got harder and harder and harder. And there were definitely, in that period of drug use, multiple rehabs and, you know, psychiatric wards and things like that. But I think the tipping point for me was I had just been using for a long time and had experienced a period of being clean for about a year. I had gone to rehab and was waiting to go to a halfway house, and they sent me to this place in Harlem to stay for a few days until my room became available, and I ended up staying there because it was this sort of radical Catholic community for addicts, and it just, you know, in this period of my life, kind of not feeling like it had a lot of meaning, and it was, you know, in a lot of discomfort and insecurity and trying to, you know, it really spoke to me, and I had always had really complicated feelings, a complicated connection to spirituality and to different, you know, different religions, and but this was kind of exciting to me. It was like a Byzantine Catholic church or denomination. This priest was this kind of amazing, charismatic, kind of radical left priest, and he had been involved with Dorothy Day, who was the who started the Catholic Worker, and other kinds of other people that had been influenced by her, and this idea that that this kind of version of Christianity was actually very radical. He wrote a book called what is it called? It's like it's based on the Little Red Book by Sherman Mao, but it's like I can't remember, something by I should tell you, it's really cool. It's like not confessions, it was like quotations from Chairman Jesus, I think it was called.
Okay, that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it was really interesting. So I got very drawn into this kind of world, and it was, it kind of gave my reality meaning. He was also gay. Mm. That's a whole complicated story too. But he had marched with Martin Luther King, and he had been involved in all these civil rights era things, and he had started this community originally for priests leaving the priesthood who wanted to still have some connection to their religion. But it was a very interesting, like, you know, I met a lot of really interesting people, like the Berrigan brothers and other kind of radical religious figures, and also people that were just activists and interesting people there. The reason I'm telling the story is there was this whole era where I was there. And then it kind of allowed me to have purpose and meaning and responsibility, and it allowed me to not take drugs. But it didn't, unfortunately, nothing was really changing deeper, you know, underneath, inside. A lot of my, you know, attitudes and behaviors and ideas still were there, but they were just kind of like suppressed by having responsibility and feeling that I was part of something really intense. And when I left there, I just, that sobriety had been so precarious, because it was really just situational rather than doing work on myself to get to a better place.
Can I ask, were you like raised in a Catholic background or religious family?
No. So my father was Jewish and my mother was Catholic, and you know, we were exposed to both, but we weren't raised in any specific tradition. We would go to, you know, temple on high holidays, and we would go to church on holidays. Or my grandmother, my Catholic grandmother, I spent a lot of time with as a child. I sometimes would spend the weekend with her, and I would go to church with her, but it wasn't anything regular, and it wasn't really, didn't really talk about religion or anything in the family.
Sure. So what was the time period you were involved in the radical Catholic
community? So that was, the community was called Emmaus House, and that was, it must have been, now my years are all weird. it must have been 94, 95, maybe.
Okay.
There were multiple times there. So I was there for a year. I left because I had put the priest that I was referring to, Father David, on this pedestal. Kind of, he was so interesting and inspiring to me. But then, you know, this was a kind of a wild reality, and so, and people are very human, and when you put people on pedestals, usually they have a propensity of falling off those pedestals if you scrutinize things deeply enough. And there was a controversy in which he had seemed to have been having some sort of inappropriate relationship with one of the people that had come as a you know, member of the community, an addict. And at first I was sure that it was, you know, not true at all. And then over time I realized that still to this day don't really know what happened, and it's very interesting to think of it and the reaction to it in relation to what has come later in terms of, you know, us as a society looking at power dynamics. And but it was clear enough to me that that was the problem. You know, it was two adults, but it was someone who had power over the other person. So initially I didn't believe it, and then over time I started, like, little bits of information started to sort of pop out, and I realized that it was true in some form or another, and left. I left and went to live with one of the people on the board of directors of the community, who had been also another really amazing, like, kind of New York activist icon. And I stayed with her, and I tried to not do drugs for. You know, I really had to, it was a struggle again. And then one day I was walking down the street, I remember on the Lower East Side, and I heard someone say my name, and then the next thing I knew, I was like, hi, it's a kite. And I don't even remember what happened, or how it happened, or why. And then I was off to the races again. So that was the beginning of, I experienced, like, life without heroin for about a year, and my life had gotten so much better, and then all of a sudden I was back in it all again. And so you know, over the next 6 months, I think, you know, it got worse and worse and worse, and that really became my you know, bottom, as they say, in recovery. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that story, or I don't know how juicy we should get.
It's up to you, whatever level of comfortable.
I mean, really what happened was, it was very intense. It was, I left and relapsed, and suddenly felt like, how am I going to, you know, how do I get out of this? And in a moment of real vulnerability, I reached out to him.
Father David,
who was so upset that I had left, but I went back. And then it just got really complicated and bad. And then I became, like, the object of I don't know how to talk about it. I don't know the right words, because, you know, yeah, I became... because it was so, you know, it, like all situations in which there are power dynamics and sex is involved, it's very nuanced and complicated, but I definitely had no power. Had all the power. And so I was in this weird position where inappropriate things were happening to me. And it just had, it started to get very strange. And I remember I called my mother and said a few words like, you know, I explained that, like, I had to sleep in the same bed as him. And she immediately got in her car and drove to New York and picked me up and took me away. And then it was a bumpy road for about a month. And I got really, really bad. And then I ended up in the hospital. And that was the beginning of my sobriety.
And when was the hospital?
That hospitalization must have been in 2000, the beginning of, the beginning of 2000.
So you've been sober for?
For 26 years.
That's wonderful.
It's crazy. It's so crazy.
And that's, I am glad that your mother was in a position to help you out of that situation.
Yes, she did, definitely. Definitely. It was a crazy situation. He's no longer alive, and I have, you know, he was an amazing person in many ways. I mean, it's complicated. I don't want to, like, oversimplify it, but it was interesting to see. It was interesting, the way that those kinds of dynamics can emerge. I've always been very sensitive to them, like hypersensitive to them, especially after this. So, you know, he was a really complicated person. He did some amazing things, and he did some, you know, not amazing things. Yeah.
All right. Thank you for sharing all that with me.
Yeah.
So after hospitalization and the beginning of your sobriety journey in 2000, how has that led up to returning to Hudson and starting Gazuri?
So let's see. So I got clean in 2000, and that was a long process. I was, you know, in a rehab, and then I was I went through a series of program that was maybe 2.5 years long. So it was the hospital, and then a halfway house, and then something called a three-quarter house, which is like a little bit more autonomous. And then I lived in apartments with other people that were in recovery. And started to go back to school, and tried to figure out what I wanted to do. And over the next, and then ended up going to Bard, going back to Bard. And in fact, I'd actually, when I was my first time around with college, had gotten into Bard and wanted to go to Bard, and but ended up at SUNY Purchase. So, but then in some of the interim periods, I did enroll in classes and stuff at Bard, but this was now me properly going back to school. And I was looking for somewhere to live, and I was working with someone who lived in Hudson, who said, oh, you should move to Hudson. And I think she helped me find an apartment, and I moved to Hudson and was at Bard for 5 years, I think. And you know, was very devoted to, I studied art with Bard and had always made, had always been an artist, but I always, you know, had this, you know, never had gone to school, never finished school or never finished anything. So going back to school at Bard at that time was perfect. I was kind of so primed for it, and I also had a lot more to contribute, and you know, was older and had experienced more, and so that was a really brilliant period where I was making a lot of work and getting a lot of, you know, attention and feedback, and yeah, that was a really powerful period. So I lived in Hudson and went to Bard. And at that time, there was very little connection between, say, Bard and Hudson, or, you know, Hudson was, in a weird way, more insular.
Okay. What time period was this, just for context?
That would be, like, 2003, maybe, onward.
Till around 2000?
Till around, I mean, it slowly, I would say, 2003 was, I mean, I think at the time it was, that was the era of a lot of, you know, like, artists, musicians, you know, gay people, but not like it is now. It was a much smaller community of people coming from elsewhere. I was like the young one, which is so funny. I was like part of the young entourage. There were very few of us. Mm. But it was a more intimate circle of people, I think, that was, you know, kind of roving around. I remember talking about gentrification in like 2003, and people just sort of like being like, gentrification in Hudson, like what? I mean, and it was already in motion. I mean, it just the way that it manifested itself here at first was so, it was like such a slow process. Now it's much more accelerated. But Hudson was great at that time for me to be in school. I had a, you know, huge apartment and a huge art studio above the apartment. I you know, it was a very interesting time. And then when I finished school, I decided to deal with some things, some health issues that I had, which meant I was delaying kind of, my plan had been to move back to New York, and then I just did, and I ended up staying here. It ended, you know, at the time it felt, now a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of artists and there's a lot of younger artists that have congregated here, and at the time it really was a place where you could find like a very cheap apartment and a studio, and there was a community of people that you would you know, engage with, and then slowly more and more, you know, younger people started to move here, I would say in the like mid 2000s. But even then, it took a long time for it to be a place where so many young people come. I think it's so interesting how so many people, when they finish school, end up coming to Hudson. That really wasn't a phenomenon before.
Do you see a connection between like the amount of young people and also sort of this transition that Hudson has made into being like the upstate gay community hub?
I know, it's so funny because so many people have different thoughts about that and what that means, and if it's a good thing or a bad thing, or who's, you know, I I guess seeing it through, having experienced, I mean, there's always been queer people in Hudson, and in fact, in a way, it felt more like radically queer in the early 2000s, mm. and I'm sure at different times, you know, because there wasn't just the same networks of people. It was much more like I said, more insular, and there were always queer people, but yeah, more and more people kind of came, but I don't know, is Hudson like a gay, it's so funny to me, I don't know what it is really in that way. Mm. There's obviously certainly a lot more visible, you know, like visibly queer culture in Hudson now. And I think, yes, young people, definitely the younger people that have moved here are definitely a huge part of that. But I think it's interesting that I don't know how, like, I've always moved in different circles, like wildly different circles, and, you know, different age groups and, you know, circles of different age groups. So I never felt like there is a separation between, say, earlier generations of queer people and younger people. I think that's probably a more broadly cultural thing as well. I don't think it's Hudson particularly. I mean, but it is. It's part of it is like class dynamics and you know, different, you know, the older, you know, gay and queer people here tend to have more resources, and then, you know, and are involved in different, you know, I'm always kind of in between all of these worlds in a very strange way. I sell very fancy Japanese avant-garde clothes, but I feel, it's never been about class, like, so I don't sound like I'm ignoring classics, but it's never been about status or, that's not why I do it, or that's not what interests me about it. There is a lot more money, there's a lot more resources amongst a larger segment of the population than there used to be. Mm. But what was the question exactly?
If you thought that there was a connection between, like, you know.
Oh, the young people coming and.
Yeah.
I think definitely, well, I think a huge part of it what is that, you know, the it's funny to say the younger generations, but the generations that sort of came after me, you know, I was definitely like the one person on the Hudson community board, like talking about like racism, sexism, homophobia, classism, and gentrification in like, you know, 2002. You know, our whole culture has, you know, developed into a place where those conversations were taking place on a much larger scale. Mm. I think that is because, and I think here particularly that is due to the influx of younger people who were being, you know, who were, you know, involved in those, you know, dealing with those issues. I feel like one of the big changes that I've seen over the years is that there's so many more groups of people working to address those things rather than just kind of the early 2000s kind of sort of obliviousness to them. You know, I think of Kite's Nest and everything that Kite's Nest has done. and you know, all the forms that it's taken and all the work that it's done. I mean, that was a huge thing. That was that was starting when I was first came here. But you know, now there's just a much larger group of people who share, you know, certain values and, you know, can get together and organize around them, which earlier on there was just a much fewer people doing that. So that's been, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting change in the dynamics of the town. But we are in a, you know, we're still in a period of, like, Hudson is always in a period of transition, and there's always the those tensions are always a big part of it.
Yes.
So,
I do want to come back to this, but I want to backtrack slightly.
Yeah.
Is there anyone, when you were at Bard in school, is there anyone that you considered a very close friend or professors that had a big impact on you? We've talked a bit outside of the library about your friend Celeste.
Yeah.
So.
Celeste, who also lived in Hudson. Celeste and I were, we met, I can't remember if we met through, I think we might have met in a recovery context and then realized that we were both starting in a few days at Bard and focusing on art. And so we were really, really close for a time. And we shared a studio at Bard. And Celeste did absolutely, like, inspire me. There's nothing more brilliant to me than watching a really good painter paint and the process of that and how it starts and stops and how it changes completely. You know, you look at the canvas, you know, I might look at one of her canvases and then the next day it's completely different, but it was such a rewarding experience for me and helped me think about the kind of work that I did, which was very different than hers in a way, but also was very political and also was full of references and like an overabundance of visual information in a way. So Celeste was an amazing person to go through that process with. You know, we also had our, you know, kind of complicated times and yeah, but very influential. I had a professor named Paul Ramirez Jonas, who's an amazing conceptual artist. He was very, he was a huge champion of me and my work, and he was amazing. Kenji Fujito is also, like, my professor that I really loved and helped me, you know, sort of channel my work in a certain way. I mean, there were a lot of professors that were really supportive of me. Judy Pfaff, people like that. But I would say Paul was the most influential. I think he just understood what I was doing the most and was really very supportive of that.
And you graduated from Bard in 2008?
Yes.
2008. All right. And going from there, how did you end up opening Kasuri and selling high-end avant-garde Japanese fashion?
So Kasuri happened because a woman, I heard that there was this woman that was opening boutique, mm-hmm. and I knew someone that was working with her, and I was at this period where I was like, I'm going to focus on my art making practice again, and had been, you know, people like Celeste would keep, we were sort of trying to coax me, Celeste and different professors and just random, you know, different artists that I knew were kind of trying to coax me back into making work and showing it. But as I said, I had, after graduation, taken a little bit of, I had a health issue that I had to do a long-term treatment for, and ended up staying. And so when I heard about this store opening, I thought, oh, well, I could help them. This is my, you know, sort of one of my areas of expertise, and just, you know, but I'll... It'll allow me to work, you know, it will allow me to focus on my work. I'm going to help them part-time. But when I got there and got involved, there was a lot of work to do. And there was a lot to figure out, and it hadn't really been figured out. And so I just kind of started to figure it all out, and then slowly over a period of time just became more, you know, I had wanted to do something like that myself, but I didn't have the resources, so it was amazing because Layla, you know, over time allowed me to kind of create something really amazing. And, you know, just sort of gave me a free hand in that way. I struggled a little bit at first because there's always this tension between like fashion and art, and fashion and art are always kind of like brought together in certain ways that are often very sort of facile and silly and superficial, but I struggled trying to find a way of like using that context as a means of expression. But I think I ultimately was able to reconcile I sort of felt like I have to keep art over here and fashion over here. Mm. And then I sort of let go of that. We grew and we started to get recognition and people appreciated what we were doing. And what we were doing was very different than most, you know, quote unquote luxury boutiques, which was, we were that, but I really wanted to create a space that people could come into and just experience the clothes and not necessarily have that. I didn't want it to be exclusionary of anyone, and I had been in Hudson long enough to see how that could happen in a lot of businesses in town. And I had friends who would, you know, for instance, who would, you know, share their experience as a black person going into a store and being, you know, followed around or treated really poorly or literally told that there was nothing here for them. And I was so shocked that that was happening here in this community that I knew. You know, when I first moved to Hudson, it did look like this idyllic kind of utopia of all these groups of people together, kind of. But, you know, very quickly I realized that was, there are lots of amazing groups of people here, and there are lots of amazing people here, and there is a lot of amazing interaction between different groups of people, but it was very stratified. in a lot of different ways. And so that kind of, you know, was part of my vision of what I wanted to happen at Kasuri, which was that it wasn't just a place to come and buy expensive things, and also, but that it also, that we sort of created culture and kind of like had different, you know, different people come, and we've had different kinds of programming. We actually did with Shanika in the library, we did a fashion workshop with kids from the library that was so incredible. With the most, probably the most incredible thing that I've done as Kasuri. And just, you know, we also, I was acutely aware that we were in a location that was not in the middle of Warren Street, and we were at the bottom of Warren Street, and we were, you know, in a, you know, at One Warren, and we were across from the apartments on the waterfront, which, you know, it was just a place where all these different, so I didn't want to be like the fancy store that plopped into the neighborhood and was excluding everyone who actually lived in the neighborhood.
Right.
And so, you know, that was really like my, what's just as important to me as anything else that we were doing. I mean, that was, it's not the most important thing. There was a lot of, you know, people would be really intimidated to come in, but we created this really special environment where like everyone felt comfortable coming in, and people would come in and just look at things and experience them and learn about them. And you know, that is my dream for Kasuri again, to kind of revive that logic. But I always loved clothes. I mean, I always loved fashion, but from a very specific angle. You know, I would say the fashion that I love is often called characterized as like anti-fashion, or it's sort of antagonistic to the certainly to certain aesthetic norms, but also just to the you know, kind of status driven silly, never ending changing marketing, money, sort of roller coaster of a certain side of the fashion world. You know, I mean, sometimes people think this is funny, but a definitely more intellectual fashion, but not necessarily like intellectual in a, it doesn't have to be serious all the time or austere, but it's just, you know, designers that think about what clothes mean and how they work and how they operate in the world and what they convey, and designers that do try to communicate things through their clothes. So when I was a kid on the farm, I discovered, probably when I was about 14, I went to visit a cousin of mine in Boston, and she took me to Newbury Comics, and I found an issue of ID magazine, and it was like, wow, it's this amazing world. But I was a kid growing up on a farm, but it just, like, the world that was being shown to me was so resonant and, like, seemed so exciting and fascinating. I was definitely, like, became a little Anglophile, and also a little, like, you know, I was, you know, went through, like, my punk era, I guess, and my post-punk era, my new wave era, I was always very interested, like, a lot of who I am came out of discovering those magazines, which were very hard to find in, you know, if you lived in Ankrumdale. But I sort of would stumble across them in different places, and then it sort of started to inform me. And so really the designers that I love the most are the same designers that I discovered then, like Rei Kawakubo and Yoji Yamamoto and you know, Vivian Westwood was huge for me. I don't pretend that, like, clothes can change the world. I don't, you know, I really love when, like, we had once Perfect 10 came to the store and we spent some time together for the afternoon. And I remember one of the girls looking at the price tag on something and saying, this is how much it cost my family. My family had to find this much money to send my sister to school last year. And I thought, wow, let's actually talk about that. Like, instead of just being like, you know, dismissive or, you know, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. And so those are the kinds of conversations that I love to have in the store, and I love to talk about and think about and, you know, work, you know, try to find ways of within our context of how we exist, dealing, you know, doing something productive around those. You know, in the past we would have fundraisers. We had, you know, during the sort of height of BLM, we had a series of fundraisers where we took the past season's clothes and marked everything down 80% to 90%, and then made it so that it was based on resources. And so no one was turned away due to the lack of funds, and it was really incredible. Like, that's like my dream. I wish the store could be like that all the time. But it was so amazing because everyone who came and took part in this really understood it. And so, you know, if you had the resources, you would pay, you know, and so there, someone might hypothetically, two people might get the same item and one person might pay, you know, $500 and one person might pay like $20. And that was a really exciting thing. And then we just distributed all that money to individuals and some groups and people who needed it. Doing what I do is interesting for me because I think a lot of times now people see me as this kind of like, you know, bourgeois gentleman or something. But I'm really much more of a weirdo than they realize. And I'm a much more complicated on all of those fronts than they realize.
Are there any projects or programming that you're hoping to put on in Kasuri going forward? I know right now you have the exhibition going on of archival fashion.
We have an archive exhibition with Y3, which is great, and we definitely want to do more of that, more artwork with archives and with different designers. We're going to start film screenings again, which we used to do. You know, we have some writers that are releasing books in the next 6 months, so we, you know, things like that. I'm kind of really looking for things that we can do in the space to just, you know, utilize that space in a way that is, you know, just to activate it. It's really important that it remain a kind of, not just a store, but a place where people feel comfortable coming and exploring and experimenting. I mean, that's really fun when someone comes in and is not necessarily, you know, a student of any of these designers, but is willing to experiment and see how it makes them feel. I definitely want to do more of the youth fashion sort of workshop, and I've been thinking about that a lot lately. and who we can, how we can make it, you know, more expansive than we were able to in the past. Yeah, those are the main things I think right now that we're thinking of.
Okay. Exciting. I will keep an eye out for those. We are drawing close to the end of our time, but I did just want to kind of loop back around. In your first oral history that was done with Community Library of Voice and Sound, and you've talked about it a bit here as well, you talked about gentrification in Hudson and sort of the issues of class, and that was recorded in, we established, like 2018, 2019, right, somewhere around there, pre-pandemic, to put it lightly. And I'm curious if you have thoughts to share on how that has changed in the last 7 or so years after the pandemic, and the sort of changes that Hudson has gone through. Because on the one hand, like you said, we do have like this wonderful politically active community. A lot of groups are active, like Kite's Nest or the Hudson Catskill Housing Coalition.
Exactly.
But there is also, I think, just a problem of capital going on, and very, very strong striations between the kind of glitterati and just sort of the working class of Hudson, I would say, and what you think could be done about that tension.
That's a really hard one, and I've been thinking about that a lot lately in terms of, I mean, one of the biggest issues in Hudson, I think, is housing and affordable housing and enough housing for people, because I think obviously as the rents get higher and higher, people can't live here. So people that have lived in the community for a really long time, or forever, or even people who haven't, but it just becomes, you know, it becomes more and more, or it becomes less and less accessible to certain people. And I think that's really dangerous and unfortunate. And I think there's, you know, I think that's something that Hudson is going to have to really figure out, and the people of Hudson are going to have to figure out, because it's not just going to be like a city, you know, the political system, you know, class sort of figuring it out. But I think that's huge. I think there's always been stratification here, but I think, like, what, you know, it sort of seems like, you know, gentrification is happening like everywhere. Like everywhere. I can't think of a place where I've been recently where it's not obvious that that's occurring. It's a, you know, it's a phenomenon that happens, obviously, but I guess the thing, you know, it's like, I don't want to pontificate on it too deeply right now, because I need to, it's the sort of thing that I have to think about when I, you know, to articulate what I'm trying to say and not sound like an idiot or not, oversimplify or but I do think that's a huge issue right now. And I know from my own, just my lived experience, that I see how it's changed the sort of demographic of different neighborhoods in town. And, you know, it's frightening. I think, too, I think things like, you know, people have lots of different thoughts about Airbnb, for instance, but I think that's one of, you know, that was one attempt at, like, trying to address you know, the rising cost of housing in a place with, where there's limited housing. But it's sort of like the cycle just continues. I don't know. I mean, the key is there needs to be more housing. I don't know. And good housing for people. Because otherwise you just end up becoming too much of, you know, you can't, there was a period of time, for instance, when like pretty much all of Warren Street was antique stores. Like it just, there wasn't very much of anything else. Now there is, but I would like to see Hudson have, you know, the kinds of places and services for people that a complex, diverse community needs in the town, rather than having to go, you know, to Fairview or whatever. And there's lots of people doing interesting things, like Rolling Grocer is brilliant in the way that, you know, the cost structure and things like that. But also it's a, you know, it's a, we need more of that. We need more things like that.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Before we come to the end, is there anything else you would like to share for your interview today? Any people you'd like to highlight in your life, or just short stories you'd like to share to kind of close this out?
I wish I could. I wish I could think of something more now, because I feel like my, I feel like I thought I was going to give like a really like juicy like queer interview, but I can't really think of anything that I at the moment.
I can always bring you back for
You can always bring me back for part two, and I would lovely, I'd happily do it. We can go in as deep as you want.
All right, Jonathan, thank you so much for coming to talk to me today, and for being so like vulnerable and lovely. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. No, I love that. I love sharing these things. I guess I'm a little more distracted than I was during my previous interview. Thank you.